life on the road. It's
booze, tacos, angry dwarves, strippers waving guns,
and
bees, fights, candle flights, running with the runs,
and
blacklists, bounce checks, great, a bachelorette. Drunks in the front, making out through your set.
And
middle acts doing blow more, missing merch.
And
drive the rental car past another mega church.
And
juice keys, vagina fist, your cell phone is gone. One big Law and Order marathon.
So we're doing an hour.
We're doing it close to
you
an hour.
To end it out.
What?
You know, you know. Were right. You were right about stories. While I was sitting there, I started writing down stories.
I know. That's what I said, man. Yeah. You'll
stuff
know
I had forgotten about.
Absolutely. Thanks for tuning in to the Road Stories Podcast, everybody. I'm your host, Murray Valeriano. We are part of the All Things Comedy Network. Go over and check out and see what's going on with All Things Comedy. Today, I have a returning comedian named Mike Ivey joining us on the podcast. Thanks for doing this, Mike.
Hey, no problem.
Mike, it's
Mike's done the Road Stories before with you.
Absolutely. He did it with Bob Golub. And shortly after that, I drove by a casting studio over here on Ocean Park, and I saw Mike walking out, and I wailed on my horn. I'm like, hey, Mike! And he's like, who the fuck is that? I have this thing where if I meet you and I like you, I automatically just make us friends.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. I like that. And you know what was good? I actually found out who the hell that was blowing at me. You know, I'm like, who was that? And later, I think it wasn't even 2 days later.
Yeah.
I ran into you and it was you.
Yeah, and I told you right there. And then joining us, a new gentleman who's infatuated with the recording process. What's going on? Do you not like your levels over there?
Just learning. Just okay. Learning. Learning.
Jonathan Solomon joins us. Comedian, writer extraordinaire. Is that a fair assessment, sir?
Yes, but right now, more so a
teacher.
Teacher instructor, yeah.
Okay. Teaching, where are you teaching these
I mean,
days?
I'm still writing, certainly. Sure. That's actually what pays more of the bills.
Right, sorry.
I teach at writers' conferences around the country.
Sure.
I teach at Santa Monica College.
Right around the corner.
Right. I teach at, and I'm at the campus right around. I always tell people interested in taking the class, we're at the Bundy campus, which you can get to.
Oh, right, absolutely.
Do you ever run into... I teach at SAG-AFTRA Conservatory, at the Writers' Store.
Awesome.
Et cetera. Wherever they'll have me.
Do you ever run into ex-comedian director extraordinaire Jordan Brady over there?
No.
Do you know Jordan?
Yeah, I know Jordan from years ago. I didn't know he was teaching there.
No, he's not teaching. He's a director, but his office is
by the airport.
Yeah,
everybody's by the airport. Yeah, no, I haven't run into him.
Until they close that airport down coming up in the next 4 years.
Really? I didn't know they were closing.
Yeah, they're closing. The next time you're over there, look at the signs that says hangars for sale.
I've seen that sign. Yeah. I didn't know what that meant. Now
and it's aircraft
and
hangars.
Why are they closing it down?
They've been trying to close it down.
And the name of the podcast, folks, is incidentally, is Airports That Are Going Out of Business.
Yeah, airport stories. Just a quick, let's just put it this way. There's been three accidents.
Really?
Three crashes since I moved into the neighborhood.
It's to keep Harrison Ford from flying.
Exactly. Where Harrison Ford crashed his plane a couple years ago, that was this airport. And then there was another one about 3 years after I moved into this neighborhood, I smelled this in my house. I smelled like this really kind of burning kind of thing. And I walked out and it was really just in the air, just like this. I'm like, what? I thought somebody's house was on fire. And my neighbor comes out who's, you know, lived here for 25, 50 years. And he goes, I bet there's a plane crash. And sure enough, a private jet crashed, killed four people. It was terrible. So they're getting rid of that airport. What happened? We'll get off the subject, I swear, listeners. They built this airport, and then they built houses up to the property.
Right.
So it's an airport surrounded by property, and planes are crashing into houses and stuff like that.
Ah. Anyway. Sort of like Mexico City.
Yeah.
If you know, like landing in Mexico City is like landing, it looks like in the middle of a street when you're coming down.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's closer than LAX is to Manchester and Century.
Speaking of Mexico City, I'll be performing in Mazatlan in 2 weeks. So any expats living in Mexico, come out to the Mazatlan Resort. And I will
Who books that? I want that gig. Mazatlan.
I'm so excited. There's a surf break right out in front of it.
That's fantastic.
It's going to be fantastic. I might even start drinking again just for
the
margaritas.
Great.
That'd be fantastic.
I've known John for years, and one of my favorite things is when you wrote for the country music.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I got a call. Well,
for the CMAs?
I was writing. A friend of mine said, I was looking for a gig, and I called a friend of mine who was running a new, and this is how early it was in the world of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that there internet handle was, might have been music.com.
Oh.
That's how early it was.
Right, right.
And I called her up and I said, you know, give me a job. And she said, well, the only thing we have left is the reviewer for country music. And you being a Jew from New Jersey, I'm sure you don't like country music. And I said, au contraire, because I'm one of the few Jews from New Jersey who loves country music.
From South Jersey.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for, actually from North Jersey. Yeah. But
not knowing how to turn down a job.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. I became a country music fan overnight.
Absolutely.
So I could have the job. Yeah.
Absolutely. Where in Jersey are you from?
South Orange.
All right, I grew up in just outside of Wayne.
Yeah. For those of you who know, for those of you, Philip Roth, the famous author, Portnoy's Complaint, and then a library full of wonderful works. The Philip Roth character, he always lived in Newark, and then the diaspora of the Jews moving to the suburbs, the next town up is South Orange.
So
that's where I lived. In, you know, legendary for all your Philip Roth novels.
That just cleared it up for all my listeners. Thank you.
Yeah.
The hub of country music.
Okay. What's that?
The hub of country music.
Yes, the hub of country
Newark,
music.
Newark, New Jersey, the hub of country music.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
It was really interesting because I like country music, and being a black man from Mississippi, I got to be honest, people thought there was something wrong with me, but I really like.
Tell them about Charlie Pride.
Yeah, Charlie Pride's also from Mississippi. You know, his first big break was opening for Willie Nelson.
Okay.
And he had already had hits on the radio. And everybody, this new guy, this Charlie Pride guy, man, he is so country. He sounds like Hank Williams Sr.
Right.
Whenever he was great. And then he opened for Willie Nelson. Willie was going to give him a break. And this next guy I'm going to bring out here, Willie says, is a great country singer. You've been hearing his songs on the radio. How about a nice hand for Charlie Pride? And Charlie comes out, and people go, that's him?
Oh, because the radio. Yeah,
yeah,
I had no idea.
And then this black man opens his mouth, and it's like, Charlie Pride is a great country singer.
Absolutely.
He's amazing. He was also a semi-pro baseball player. He tried to make the major leagues as a pitcher. Off story here. And actually, one of his distant cousins ended up playing in the major leagues and was one of the few deaf players that ever played in the major league.
See, that's the kind of off story I like to hear.
Curtis Pride.
Philip Roth. That's the
and he was an outfielder, right, which makes you really wonder about depth perception and how important it is. Because I played baseball, and that was one thing that you really used in the outfield. And always amazed me that a deaf guy could play as good as he was. He was like an all-star center fielder.
The other thing I like about Charlie Pride is what the hell's his name? He name checks him in his song. Oh, crap. You never called me by my name. Who sang that? Oh, anyway, it turns out I'm blanking on it. Oh, David Allen Coe.
Oh,
David Allen Coe. Name checks him. David Allen Coe, the biggest asshole racist out there. It's so funny. Don't bother even to go listen to that song. It's terrible. That was my segue back in.
I've got
show.
A segue about just so people who don't know. Well, you've done the show before, but Mike Ivey's story. Mike Ivey's one of the, and comedy fans should understand this. You can be famous for what you did on stage. You can be famous for how many television. You can also be famous, and this is the case of Mike Ivey, for being hilarious off stage.
Right.
For saying legendary one-liners in real life. And we were playing, I still remember this. We were playing improv softball in Central Park.
Sure.
And we got our mitts and we're walking through Central Park.
You're playing for the improv team.
Yeah. And Mike, it must have been me and Mike and maybe Ken Ober and Lou DiMaggio, a few of us walking through Central. And there's a tether ball and there's little kids. And we turn and we see this little kid, couldn't have been more than 7, and he's trying to hit the tether ball and he just can't hit it. And it's so sad. And my heart goes out to him. And I want to say something. Oh, this poor boy. I relate to him, you know, because when I was a kid, I wasn't. And Ivy goes, hasn't been the same since he got out of rehab. And, you know, it's 35 years later. I remember
right,
that line.
That's awesome. Ken Ober, I got to meet before he passed on. He was producing, he had gotten out of stand up and had started to produce TV. And I met him at a Writers Guild function. And I was a big fan because I was a big fan of remote control
right.
on MTV yeah. back when I was in high school. So yeah. I was really stoked to meet him.
Ken Ober and I did 3 years in a row. We did the commentary for a celebrity golf tournament, Richard Karn Star Days.
Uh-huh.
And Richard Karn Star Days was in Seattle. It was a one-day golf tournament, and then Home Improvement game so big that by within 5 years, it was a four-day event with a softball game in the Seattle Mariners Stadium. But we would do, they gave us the little ESPN shirts, we were up in a little thing, and we'd do a little commentary, but there was no technology for us to actually commentate on the golf. So when we got back to LA, they would put us in some guy's studio in somebody's garage, and me, Ken Ober, and Roger Lodge was the sort of color, was the, I don't know, he was the name guy.
Right. Why do I know Roger Lodge? What is that?
He's the radio.
He was doing radio sports. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sport, the Roger Lodge.
Yeah. So we would sit in the garage, and there would be like Samuel L. Jackson playing golf, and maybe he was paired with Bill Gates.
Sure.
But we knew the clips. We'd been there, and then they'd play the clips. So Ober and I would go. First, we had the whisper, you know. But then we knew what was shot, so we'd say, like, Samuel Jackson's got a 10-foot putt there. I'm guessing that's about just outside left. If he's going to miss it, he's going to miss it to the high side. And then... that play the video, and then we'd go, missed it to the high side. We looked like the most prescient golf commentators ever.
Over.
And then they showed it. I have the clip, but they showed, this is how, you know, ESPN needed content
sure,
in those
absolutely,
days. Very
absolutely.
Different. They showed that thing Thanksgiving morning 3 years in a row on like ESPN Latino.
Right.
That was what they did with that clip.
Ober was very funny.
Oh, he's
yeah.
He was also... my first friend in comedy after I met Kevin Rooney.
Okay.
I met Ken Ober in Massachusetts, and we worked together twice a week. I had a show at the top of the campus at the University of Mass, and Ken had a show at the Hot L Warren. And man, we had so much fun.
Oh, I bet.
He came up with the craziest ideas. One time we rapidly deployed as a tactic in a race. You race from one part of Massachusetts to a big town called Northampton, but you can't, it was on the river, and you can't use motorized vehicle. So people would build all these boats, make them out of bathtubs. And
right,
all
right.
It was a great, funny day. Ken decided that we would rapidly deploy. We left town crawling on our stomachs, dressed in full army gear that we got from the ROTC on campus. And then we went all the way out of town. And then we got in a car and drove to a friend's house, had breakfast, then got to the end of the race before everybody was arriving, and then rapidly deployed the last block.
Right.
And we won.
So you were the Rosie Ruiz's of Massachusetts marathon running.
Yeah, luckily it wasn't a real official race.
Right, sure.
And we moved to New York together.
Oh, you and Ken?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
We moved September 1st, 1982. We moved.
A day that will live in infamy.
Yes. Never forget. Never forget.
The day that comedy was born in New York.
So 82. So then he got remote control, I want to say in 87?
Yeah, that's about right.
That's about right, I think.
That's about right.
Yeah. And that was a great show. That also launched Sandler.
Colin Quinn
also. Sandler was on. And somebody else. I forget who it was.
Mark Cohen was the audience warm-up guy.
Mark Cohen?
Cohen.
Mark Cohen?
Yeah.
Wow, he's still around. He's doing
He's the
Vegas.
MC. He's the house MC at the Comedy Cellar in Vegas.
Oh, that's right, because he was out in Vegas doing the Rat Pack show for a long time.
He did do that. Yeah that's right.
Okay,
right.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Dead ringer for Joey Bishop, and yet.
my improv New York 80s Mike Ivey story has nothing to do with me. And that's actually not even my story. I was watching, it might have been the Gary Shandling documentary that Apatow and Wayne Fetterman did, or it was something, or maybe it was that documentary that Bud Friedman put out on the improv. I don't remember. But I'm watching it on like you know, movie channel 473, you know, something way down the thing. And Sarah Silverman is talking and she's like, yeah, you know, I was thinking about giving up comedy, but then Mike Ivey said, hey, let's stay in New York and join the softball team. And that's why she stayed in New York and joined the softball team. And so I took a still of it and I took it and I'm like, hey man, Sarah Silverman's name checking you on this show.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite things. She gives me credit for her playing softball at the Improv, and I got big kudos because, of course, she's a woman, and some of the guys were upset that I would play a woman.
That you would put, that you recommended that you would play her on the softball team?
Yeah, and I mean, I played her. I had to tell people right to their face, honestly, man, she's a better second baseman. If she couldn't play, I wouldn't be playing her. I never told her that.
Right, of course. Right.
Know?
So, but, were you a New York guy also?
Yeah.
Solomon?
Yeah.
Were you on the softball team?
Yeah, I wasn't very good.
You're on
but
Catch
I
a
was
Rising
on
Stars.
So. No. I think by then I had figured out that it didn't raise my profile at a comedy club to also be in the outfield.
Ah, like, that makes sense.
And a lot of people thought that.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. I
oh,
believe
they thought,
it.
Oh, I'll join they, the team yeah, and then I'll get better spots.
Yeah. And that was like. That was like far
I don't know if
from
that,
the truth.
If that, I guess that's possible.
Unless
if you're a good
you
athlete, you get better
strip.
Spots. I guess that is possible.
Hmm.
Yeah, because whatever would raise your profile. Yes, but yeah. I was I'm a skinny Jewish kid from South Orange, New Jersey.
Right.
Where Philip Roth, we're not great athletes. We're
right.
not great. Athletics is not going to raise our profile in some other area.
Sure, of course.
A side note: Philip Roth was an excellent softball player.
You know, actually, I know so much about Philip Roth, I could actually go into a Philip Roth story, but I will skip it.
Now, did this legendary Improv New York softball team play other clubs?
Yeah.
Or so you played against like...
It was the Broadway Show League.
Actually, the Performing Arts League.
A Performing Arts League.
Oh,
okay.
Interesting.
So we played Catch. We played
Catch a Rising Star.
Did Catch have a team? I remember Strip had a team. Yeah.
Played the comic strip.
Yeah.
Did you play like productions like Cats or anything like
actually,
that?
Actually, it was... the local musicians union.
Okay.
802. And there was an acting school.
Okay.
That we played. Those guys with the pink shirts.
I was like, I don't remember. It was the 80s. There were a lot of drugs.
Stratford. They were called Stratford. We played each team about four times a season.
All right.
Played doubleheaders 1 year. Every Monday we played.
Who else was on the team? So you got Mike Ivey, you got Jonathan Solomon, you got Sarah Silverman.
Well, the two
Ken
I remember
Ober.
Was Ober and DiMaggio. I remember them because, you know, I shouldn't be telling these stories because I really did. When Ivey talks about it, I realize Ivey must have played for a while. But the Lou DiMaggio, Ken Ober battle, right?
They had a big fight.
Dust up, yeah.
Oh, Lou DiMaggio, who, by the way, I've lost several TV writing jobs to.
Yeah.
So that's the only we've ever met face to face. I just look on the credits of the show I didn't get. I'm like, oh, of course, Lou's got it.
Larry David played on
Larry David
right.
played.
That's right.
Danny Aiello.
Oh, he was a doorman?
No.
That's
no,
Ricky Aiello
was
a doorman.
Ricky.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh. How was Danny involved in the Improv?
He was, when the Improv started, it wasn't. Just a comedy club.
Sure.
It was a place that actors, Broadway actors and singers and people met on Sunday afternoon. It was like a tea house kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And they had like, what's the guy's name? The big famous director, Woody Allen. Would be there.
Nice.
And Danny Aiello was an actor who was friends with a lot of the comedians, like he knew Uncle Dirty and
Uncle
Robert
Dirty.
Klein. All those guys were friends.
Okay.
And then some guys wanted to be comedians, and they actually got on stage and proved that they, you know, I'm not going to get really into it, but John Amos tried to do stand-up.
Oh, really?
He was on Good Times.
Yeah, and then Roots.
Have you seen him? Yeah.
Not good?
Well.
You don't want to pass judgment.
No, I don't really have to pass
judgment. It's been passed. The judgment has been passed.
Yeah. You get my drift.
All right. So
Ray Romano.
Sure.
Played.
Okay.
There was other Marty Rackham.
All right.
Who was famous for his turn on Seinfeld.
Oh, which one did he play on Seinfeld?
Jake Jarmel. He was that guy.
You know, it's funny. When Seinfeld, and by the way, Jerry Seinfeld is one of the comics I was watching in high school through the 80s that really inspired me to be. But I never saw Seinfeld because as soon as I started doing stand-up, I was out every Thursday night.
You didn't have a VCR?
But no, dude. I was a struggling comedian right out of school. I had barely had enough for Top Ramen at that. So I never saw Seinfeld. So wow. I'll catch it on repeats every once in a while. But wow. But I never saw it first run. That's a little about me, Mike. What do you
really?
Think? Yeah.
So now you catch it up with...
Now I can honestly say I've seen 20 all the way through. Maybe that.
Yeah.
Maybe that. It depends on like when Rick Overton's on my podcast, and I've seen everyone he's been on. I always say that. And then when Jan Karam's on, oh, yeah, I saw yours. I haven't really seen him yet.
Yeah. I was in the... I can't say that I watched a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I have... Like you, I've caught a lot of them in reruns.
Sure. That's a good thing about reruns.
Yeah.
Now, Jonathan did one of the things that I love. He took notes. A lot of people come on here and they'll be like, what are we doing today? Oh, we wrote stories. I don't have those. And then I have to pull teeth for an hour. But Jonathan, the good work ethic, brought notes today.
Oh, I didn't. Oh, you're talking about the piece of paper I have in
yes.
my hand. No, that.
Wait, you didn't bring notes?
No, not really. That's for...
All right, Jonathan,
I'm going to get a call sometime this afternoon from my ghostwriting agency in New York about pitching on a book.
Oh.
So I'm trying to come up. But while we were doing... Can I say we were doing a podcast earlier?
Sure, absolutely.
Some stories began to occur to me, as you said they would.
Oh, know? And then you took notes on that.
Yeah.
So you still kind of took notes.
Yeah.
So you still kind of...
Yeah,
okay.
Right in real
Which
time.
Is interesting because one of the things I remember about you... from when we did stand-up at the Improv in New York, is that you used to tape
set. I got a story about
it
that.
It used to drive me insane.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Every
that
set,
That was so
man.
Dumb. And maybe new comedians can learn from this. It was such a dumb premise I had in my head. Not a joke premise, but why I should tape them was because a bit will sometimes have its heyday in your own act.
You sure. know?
So for 3 months, it'll be funnier than it might be otherwise. And I was always thinking, and this was even before I started doing Letterman and TV spots, I was thinking, well, I want to have a record of it when it was at its best so that if I now, putting a set together, I'll put back-to-back all the clips of the best performance of that bit. So which doesn't work at all. Because you're just into some sort of natural rhythm with a bit, and then it goes away. But I had all these tapes.
Mm-hmm.
So thank God I have all these tapes.
And
so
I
left them in a shoebox, and mm-hmm. I had endless tapes. And then finally, I'm moving to L.A. So I got a storage locker in Hoboken. So I put in some 50s modern furniture in there.
Sure,
and
absolutely.
I was going to take to L.A. And a bunch of other stuff in shoeboxes. And then I go out to Los Angeles, and then I get a call that I'm doing Letterman again. I fly back to New York, and there's a snowstorm.
Okay.
For the first time ever, I said, can I do, I've got a snowstorm bit. And it would have looked, I'd already done Letterman once, so I figured twice. It'll be so impressive that I've got a bit. It's snowing today. It's a snowstorm. So I go, this is great. And I know I have the tape, mm-hmm. so I can go listen to the tape and just knock it out of the park. I go look for the shoebox. It's in Hoboken in storage.
Right, right.
So I go out. Someone gives me a ride out to Hoboken, and I go into the storage container, and I can't find it. So if you go back, it's not on YouTube, but if you find it somehow, you'll see me doing a very weak 90-second bit about the snowstorm, because I literally couldn't remember the punchline.
Right.
But I had already told Robert Morton or whoever was the segment producer, I'll do the snowstorm bit.
Wow, that's a huge coup for late night television, especially nowadays when you literally have to put word for word in writing and give it to the network. So the fact that they let you switch gears so quickly is...
No, I hadn't even thought of that.
It's
that
such
was a
huge
compliment?
Coup.
Oh,
yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah.
You know, there was another set.
It wasn't a compliment, but you could take it that way.
Oh, okay. I'll take it as a compliment.
It was just...
Well, that they trusted me. They trusted me enough to do it.
The truth.
Actually, the saddest thing about that bit was that night was... I was supposed to... The first time I did Letterman, I sat down with Dave.
Oh, okay.
The second time I didn't. So the third time I was hoping to. So it's up in the air. They don't tell you.
Let's give a time frame. What year was this?
91, 92,
so he had moved over to CBS? 94.
I did two at NBC and then CBS.
Did one at CBS. Yeah. Okay.
So I had a bit that I was supposed to do. Yeah, this isn't Road Stories, incidentally. This is in New York City.
That's right. We were talking about Philip Roth earlier. We're getting closer.
Yeah, and I had a bit that I used to do about, it's one of my first bits, I remember, is my grandmother lives in, the premise was that my grandmother lives in Florida.
Go to Hoboken and get
Florida.
The tape, see if you
can. I'll go to Hoboken, yeah. Is my grandmother lives in Florida, right, and I go down to visit her, and I go to the wrong apartment. And I say hello to the woman, but it slowly dawns on me that she's the wrong grandmother, and I don't want to upset her. But then the thread that ran through it was grandparents always give you an envelope with $10.
Right, right.
So I took the $10 and I left. And then I went next door and told the next lady, she's my grandmother. I was in Miami 3 days. I made $18,000. So that was the bit I was going to do. So what was going to happen was Dave, who wouldn't stick to his prompts anyway.
Right.
You know, he would give you a prompt to send you, and he would say something, and you'd just have to sort of... But anyway, he was supposed to say, so you dressed up for the show, because I'd never worn a tie at NBC, but I wore a tie at CBS. So he was going to say that, and then I'd go, yes, I dressed up for you, and, you know, Dave, you should be flattered. I love the show. And the only other person I dress up for is my grandmother, who, by the way, and then I'd go into
right,
the bit.
Sure.
Steven Seagal is the first guest out. And if you ever watch Letterman, he didn't suffer actors...
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
but Steven Seagal, he really did. Steven Seagal comes out in a full-length out. He's doing a movie about something in Alaska with tribesmen or something.
Okay.
So he's wearing a full regalia Alaskan, and it goes down to his ankles, and it's got these Indian colors and Native American colors and beads and all this stuff. And then he sits down with Dave. And Dave says, how are you? And he says, oh, but I got to tell you, when I was flying back from the movie, and he proceeds to do, and you got to help me out on this. There's an old joke where the punchline is the woman stows a dog, her dead dog, in the cargo bay of a plane.
Uh-huh.
And then the plane thinks they killed it, so they get a live one to replace it. And then the woman comes to her dog, who she's going to bury, and the buried dog's alive. Do you know the joke?
No.
It's an old, you know it?
No.
Okay. It's an old Google joke.
Sure.
Right?
And Seagal's telling... This is
so Steven Seagal goes into the show as if it's a true story that happened to him. And Letterman, you could see Letterman's eyes. He wanted him, if you could have edited out all of Steven Seagal
absolutely.
And just found another 20 minutes.
Because I'm sure Letterman knew this joke.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm the only one who doesn't at the moment, the three of us. No, it's an old, old, old joke, which you can see is based on the idea that truly a dog died in the cargo. So so Seagal is saying this really happened to my dog. It made no sense at all. So Letterman is just glaring at him. And I'm backstage, and I'm going, when Letterman says to me, so you dressed up, I'm going to say, well, you know, I was going to even be better well-dressed, but Steven Seagal wore what I was going to wear.
Right.
And I was thinking, if I get to say this, I'll get a development deal out of that one
dude,
line.
Oh, dude, that is out of the park.
Yeah.
That is out of the park.
Well, the out of the park part is they didn't have time for me to do.
Oh, panel. You didn't go to
they
panel?
Didn't have to do the line, no.
Fucking Seagal and his goddamn story.
Actually, I'm so glad we were doing this podcast, because now... America,
you can get this out.
Had they given me, yes, I would have had that line.
You know who he is.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
I got to say about Letterman, you notice over the years, strictly after I think either had the heart attack or the shingles, he became much more personable.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first time I did it, when during the break I said thank you and all, he literally acted as if he didn't hear what I said.
Right.
He was so, he didn't.
He's insane.
Yeah.
Letterman's insane.
Oh, I don't know if he was insane.
It was the heart attack.
He just didn't, and you know, he wasn't a touchy feely guy.
He's
but
insane.
By the time, I don't know if he's
okay,
insane.
Okay, we call
by
it
the
insane.
Time,
all right,
so, you go with insane.
Hold on. Allegedly insane.
Okay. Cover I've never heard that.
Really? Oh,
I thought that, I'm just speaking of the fact that he was not a warm, he was not Mr.
He's
Warm.
He's not a warm, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But by the third time I did the show, and I almost got choked up. It was so unusual. Is I'm standing off to the wings, and during the commercial break, he waves and gave me a what do you call this?
An okay.
An okay, yeah. So, and that, what I think, was post-heart attack.
Oh,
so
yeah,
he'd become
sense.
Like Menchie, comparatively.
Facing
so
death
even,
will do that.
And then he began to, when actors went on and told their ridiculous stories, he you know, like he did Seagal. No one came on and told about the dead dog in cargo again. But he was more, more affable.
I used to watch.
To apologize to Cher. That was my favorite episode. You know, Dave, you really are an asshole.
Yeah, I totally. She just called him an asshole right in the front. I used to watch Letterman in the 80s when I was growing up, and that's where I saw all my, you know, all these. I think it's cool. I'm just not playing ageism, but I'm a little younger than you guys, so it's cool for me to to meet and become friends with like Alan Havey and all those guys that I saw and you guys and have you guys on my show. So it's always really fun for you guys to come on, so I really appreciate it. But I remember watching. I used to watch growing up in Jersey. I would watch Letterman. My mom would watch Live at 5, the news show. And that's the one Letterman used to shoot ping pong balls into.
Right,
and
right.
So we would watch that happen in real time and then stay up and watch Letterman that night and watch it happen from his end.
Did you go out to Jersey gigs and see people?
I was in Jersey. I grew up in Jersey.
Right. So I'm saying, did you go to the ground round and see comedians?
No, I was. My dad was a preacher, so I wasn't. Entertainment was a huge sin up until I was in my teens. Wow. So I hardly.
Here's a segue. I have a story. I have a road story about a preacher.
Oh.
Yeah. Let me edit this out in post. I got to remember how this works.
It has to do with Philip
Roth. There was a guy named Jerry Stanley, who I'm sure has been covered on this show.
I don't probably.
Murray, you're not?
Jerry Stanley?
From
Well,
Jersey.
He's written up in he's a lot of the books. He's certainly in I Kill, the Mark Schiff.
Stanley Geeks. Yeah.
Oh, Stanley that Geeks. Was Rich Scheidner's book, wasn't it?
Yeah, with Mark Schiff.
Oh, with Mark Schiff. Yeah. Oh, I didn't. Schiff had it. Okay.
It's in a couple of the books. Jerry Stanley was the guy who figured out locally, and they were called Jersey gigs, that there are all these empty discos. This is why, comedy boomed in the late 70s, early 80s, right?
Okay. I mean,
it's pretty well known. Is there are all these dance spaces that now were fallow, and they went, hey, we'll put comedians in there. And they'd pay the same amount they came to pay to go to a dance club, but they had to pay the comedians. I think we got $50 plus cab.
The headliner got $100.
75. No, I think the headliner got 75. And then the middle, and then the...
Sure.
Yeah, there was an old... And somebody got to drive. If you had a car, you could drive, and you didn't have to be funny, which led to the joke, kind of they elect guys to the Comedy Hall of Fame. They need a headliner in the middle, and then a guy to drive. So Jerry Stanley had these gigs.
Those gigs have been brought up several times. I don't think Jerry Stanley's name has been...
Yeah,
in my
Jerry... There's another guy named Jim Balazos and Jerry Seinfeld. But for the long time, even a Jim Balazos gig, Jim Balazos produced the other gigs with his wife, Michelle, but they were called Stanley gigs. Like, if you did a gig in Connecticut from Joey Novick and another booker, they were called Stanley gigs, in my memory of it. So we went to South Jersey, and in the car, you drive down in the car, me... I don't know who the MC was, and Sam Kinison.
Okay.
So we get down to, maybe Ocean City. No, Ocean City's too far south. But we're somewhere parallel to
close
the
to the shore. Okay.
So it's at least, from New York City, it was an hour and a half drive.
All right.
This story doesn't have a big punchline.
That's
I just thought preacher on the road, and
no,
I went to
listen,
the,
don't. Okay.
So we do this gig.
Mike, come up with a punchline.
Yeah, go. Please, Mike, your start. I'll tell Mike. Can we take 5 minutes? I'll tell Mike a story. He'll write a punchline. So I do my gig, and then Kinison goes on. And no one knows Kinison. He's not a name yet. And I go into the bathroom, and I'm in the stall, and I hear these two Jersey boys going laudatory things about me.
Uh-huh.
That first guy was funny. And then they go, that other guy who's just yelling at us, don't ever get married. Look at this face.
Sam. Yeah.
And they hated him. So he'd been basically yelling at them.
Right.
And I just sat in the stall going, that's my career. I'm not a genius.
Right.
I'm appreciated by two guys from South Jersey who are missing. Because by then, comedians already, we revered Kinison.
Sure.
So I was like, that's it. That's my level of genius, is I'm going to be revered by two kids in Ocean City, New Jersey, but not.
How
but
smart
who don't
you
get Kinison.
But so the preacher tie-in is Kinison?
Yeah. Oh, because his family was preachers.
Oh, that's
He was a father.
I know that, but that's a stretch of a segue.
All right. Okay. I'll go with that. But weren't
that's
his family?
That's nice of you to call it a segue.
Wasn't their family in? There are 10 preachers.
His dad was a preacher.
And he talked about it.
Yeah,
he had that very preachery tone.
My dad, as a preacher, when he would see Kinison, he saw Kinison did a panel with Carson one night.
Yeah.
And as much as my dad and I, my dad was. I always say the pendulum swings both ways. So, you know, he was in the Navy beating up people in Laos, and then he became a Christian. The pendulum, he eventually settled in the middle. I don't know why. Yeah, I don't know why I'm doing that. Like, my dad listens to this show. But we would watch Carson together, and he watched Kinison. And Kinison was talking about his, you know, growing up around preachers, and he goes, you can just turn it on just like that. And he started going into preacher mode. And right. I remember my dad was like, oh my God, that is so true.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I've seen so many people do that in actual preacher world, not just comedy.
If it wasn't for my belabored, tortured segue, you wouldn't have gotten to tell that story.
And they didn't have a punchline either.
Yeah.
Where were you on that one, Ivy?
Do you need punchline?
Actually, that's a question. Can we just tell stories, or we didn't have a great wrap up?
I thought it was road stories.
Right. Good
not
point.
Road ha ha.
We've been here now for half an hour, and the furthest we've gotten on the road is South Jersey.
Yeah, well,
I mean, we played all the way to.
How much farther do you want to go?
Well, geez, we played all over
on
the country.
You in the car with, right?
Well, no, but I mean, you know, the road, I don't think the road counts. The road is staying overnight at a comedy condo.
No, I'm doing the That's Irvine Improv tomorrow night. Yeah. It's going to take me 3 hours to get there. I consider that the road.
Right.
That's, yeah. And it is.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So what were the, all right, so you had Stanley gigs. What were the other gigs, one-nighters up there?
Balazzo's.
I think Fetterman.
Phil Selman.
Selman?
Yep.
Joey Novick,
who's now a politician, I hear.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In South Jersey, he's a politician. He's like a alderman, ran for mayor of the town he lived in. Joey Novick.
All right. I figured Solomon, no, he's a big politics guy. I'm just assuming that.
I am a big, yes.
Yeah, I'm just
absolutely.
Assuming that.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of others. There were a couple of other people who booked, the people on Long Island.
Yeah.
They had a whole circuit out there, and then Scarpetti.
Mm-hmm.
It started.
I know that Scarpetti name. Yeah,
Scarpetti. Then it
politics should get you into trouble on the road.
Like they do now.
They do now. Yeah, yeah. It was a more innocent time though.
Yeah, I think it's a more innocent. Like I do, and I won't go into this again because we talked about it several times. I have one joke about Donald Trump, and it's not even about Donald Trump, and it just fucking divides a room in half. Just mentioning the name, it's ridiculous. We have a no politics rule on this show, by the way.
Well,
unless I have Jimmy Dore on or Rick Overton, then I suspend it.
You know what's upsetting about that is it doesn't divide the room. It just points out that the room is divided.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't acceptable anymore.
Oh, that makes sense.
You know, before, I mean, you could say whatever you wanted to about any politician.
I don't think that's it, actually, though. What I think it is there's even the people, if you were to do a show where everyone supported Trump and you did pro-Trump jokes, I find it still doesn't get a laugh because there's such a sense of dis-ease with people with Trump. There's such a wide range of emotions and conflicts and fears. And even if you support him, that it's just not conducive to laughter because the premise of the guy, if you did a joke about Ronald Reagan, it's something like he's dumb, right? He's an actor.
Right.
With Trump, there are so many facets represented by the fact of him, even if you support him or if you virulently don't like him, that the joke... There's too much tension for the joke to get the laugh.
So he's like cancer.
Yeah.
You know, not to be serious. If you bring up cancer, it's really tough to get a laugh. People get upset.
I think it's easier to get a joke with cancer.
Okay. See, it's hard. Yeah.
Do you know the story of the...
It's hard for me to believe that that's what it is. Because funny is funny. And it's not...
Go to a comedy club and watch someone do a pro-Trump or a negative joke. Doesn't matter who's in the audience.
I won't even use...
Not pro or con. Funny.
I disagree with you.
I think one of the things... Okay, this is what I'm thinking about.
Let's do road stories. The last thing I want to talk about
way,
is
I
Donald
just said
Trump.
There are no
See?
Politics
yeah.
on this
yeah.
show.
Well, we're not
I'm
supporting
not talking
her.
Politics. This is the thing that I have a problem with. Just let me say what I mean, and then you can tear it down.
That sounds good.
You know, I don't want you to agree with me. Just hear me, at least.
Right. See, this is not...
I'll tell you real quick. Yeah.
I don't think funny is funny. I think, for lack of better words, enlightened people or it's funny is funny. But when you look at somebody who's offended by something, they usually say, well, if it was funny, I would have laughed. I wouldn't be offended. Like, well, no, because that topic is you're already against. So you're not going to find it funny no matter how funny it is. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of, I'll tell you a bombing story, though.
Okay.
I'm just a road story.
But I agree with you. To us, funny's funny, but not to everybody.
No, with Trump.
I think this is a different show, but if you get into the weeds, there's a question. I'll tell you a bombing story. The only time people always think, I'm just trying to rescue us from Trump because he gives me agita too if discussing anything about him.
Except what you want to say.
No, I'm not saying anything left. I'm not going to mention him again. I think starting out comics think that you bomb when you start. And I didn't find that to be true. If you're comfortable with not being funny, like William Cornell, there's a comedian William Cornell, this great line when we were starting out, and he'd look at the audience, and he wasn't getting many laughs. None of us were. We didn't have a real strong set. We'd play this place around the corner from the improv. And a joke would sort of go over, you know, and he'd go, how many people think I'm funny? And the audience immediately felt sort of on the spot because they got to raise their hands. And that sort of, you know, hesitantly, begrudgingly raise their hands. But then he would jump in before they could even raise their hand, and he would say, how many people just like me anyway? And the anyway acknowledged the fact that he wasn't funny. He'd get this huge laugh for it. It showed that likability, and if you're comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember bombing, because late night when the audience was dead, I was like, hey, the audience is dead. And I think a lot of comics are that way. The first time I ever bombed was at a huge rally for AMFAR.
What's AMFAR?
AMFAR is the AIDS organization. I think I have the right name for it.
Okay.
It was run by Elizabeth Taylor.
Okay.
And it was on the lot at Universal. And I did one of the first, I really did. I know I'm tooting my own horn, but I did some of the first, like, somewhat enlightened bits about gay men on Letterman and on shows. In fact, on Letterman, I had this like 3-minute hunk, and they said, only do 2 jokes because you don't want to do too much of this.
Right. All right.
I didn't say in those words.
Sure.
So I went out to, I did this AMFAR benefit, and I was so inspired that I was doing this because I had done these. Oh, so back in New York, I had done these AIDS benefits. And one of the lines I used to do was I would go, you may have seen me today at the AIDS rally. I was the guy, I would say something about, I'm a heterosexual, but I support gay rights. You may have seen me at the AIDS rally. I was the guy marching with the sign that said, I support gay rights, but I ain't no fucking cocksucker.
Right.
And the militant gays in New York, that was it. Then they would laugh and they were with, so I go out to this benefit in L.A., and I do that joke, and and then I do a couple others from the thing, and I'm just in the toilet. And it was the only time I ever, and the woman from Little House on the Prairie, who was the hosting the thing, comes out and tries to get me off stage.
Karen Grassel?
It was one of the lesser.
That was the mom.
I think it was one of the daughters.
Okay. I can't believe I pulled her name out of my ass, and I couldn't bring the daughter's name out of my ass.
It's so good to have it out.
I say no, I'm not leaving the stage. And some guy yells out, he says, I've seen you before, you were funny that time. So I did, but anyway, the point I wanted to make is, it depends on the audience.
Sure.
Because I was doing stuff that in New York, and I later called my cousin, who is gay, and he said, oh, you poor man. The party boys are in West Hollywood. The militants are in New York, so of course you're going to bomb. And then I said to the audience, I said, I had this bit, my cousin announced he's gay. It's hard to accept that someone's gay, even if you support them. Because with my cousin, I would say, I know you're gay, I accept it, but look at the way that woman's skirt wraps around her butt. And he would say, yeah, that'll happen with linen fabrics. And so I did that to the audience, and they laughed. And I said, see, you're laughing at the one joke that plays on a stereotype. Of homosexuality. And then with that, now I showed him, and then I stormed off the stage.
So you educated him before you left. That's what audience loves.
Yeah, white heterosexual guy. Informed the gay audience.
Actually educated yourself.
Yeah.
Don't know.
Yeah. Well, must have. You learned something from that.
Yeah. Well, I learned basically when I called up my cousin later that night.
Right.
And he said, you were at the wrong audience.
But when you told a joke, when you first told a joke, to me it sounded like it would have been funny, even if you didn't add, I ain't no fucking, just say I don't suck. that might have been enough.
Are you a Christian? What's going on over there? You can't
say
cock? All right.
I am, but I'm...
You want me to clean up my act 25 years later?
I'm just saying that I'm just wondering if that would have been... That would have offended
maybe,
him.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. A PG version of the... Yeah. I think, though, there was just a very different
because
crowd.
When they when they're not, like, you know...
I support... Let me just try it out. I support gay rights, but I ain't no cocksucker. I think cocksucker's going to...
You think cocksucker's the winner?
That well, no, I think use the F word before it's still going to be a problem.
Ain't no fucking.
Listen,
God.
I'm not booked for that gig again, so we don't need to keep figuring out what I should
listen,
do.
Listen,
right?
You raised awareness, and that's all that counts.
Yeah,
that's there was awareness raised that AIDS is an epidemic, and this comic is bombing.
So huge, you know.
Well, they say you get them in the first minute, you got them.
Yeah,
the audience has to like you.
Yeah, but you also have to. What's that phrase? Calling the room. You have to say what's going on.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
You have to be in the moment.
Like Silver brought up, remember when we did the last, she brought up that Lincoln Center?
Silver Friedman is Bud's ex-wife.
Yeah, that I had done the Lincoln Center gig.
Okay, sure.
And I opened for, not only was it Lincoln Center, I'm sure I was intimidated, but it was Sarah Vaughan, mm-hmm. Billy Eckstein, Phyllis Hyman, I think was her name.
Yeah. I don't know Phyllis Hyman. Singer. Okay.
Yeah. And one other older jazz singer. Yeah.
Okay.
So my opening line was, which was not a line, obviously, I used any other time, was I said, because I was the opening act.
Right.
You know, I wasn't like Billy Eckstein, And I said, thank you, Billy Eckstein, Phyllis Hyman, Sarah Vaughan, and blah, 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 and Jonathan Solomon. Which one of these is not like the other? And that immunized me to being out of place.
Sure.
I got this huge laugh. You've stated the problem.
Right.
And everything after that was fine.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mike?
Yes.
Questions?
No, I don't have any questions. But the audience has to like you, even if they don't know it. You know, I played a room once in South Florida, one of those seizure villages. And I'll never forget it. They bring me up, and I start talking, and then this old man in the front row goes, "What? I can't hear him. It's too low. It's too low." And I said, "Okay, sir, we'll get the sound technician to adjust the sound, get the sound up." And then I started talking again. "It's too loud. It's too loud. It's hurting my ears." And I go, "Wow, too soft, too loud. I should have wrote you people a damn letter." And I'm going to tell you, nobody laughed. Not one person in that room laughed. I knew it was over before it began.
Hey, we're kind of hemming in the home stretch. So what ideas did you jot down that you wanted to hit?
Oh,
you can grab your piece of paper. It's right behind you.
Any stories that I forgot?
I hear my wife coming home and she's on the phone. I'm going to close this window.
Oh, right. I was thinking of great, one went to the other, of great, I don't know what to call the category, is great one-liners that
great
saved
one-liner?
The show.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
I always tell the story a lot, but the biggest laugh I was ever on stage for was not my line.
Okay.
I was the comedian, but it wasn't my line. It was at the, is this a good road story?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll tell you in a minute.
Say, it's amazing we've had road stories and we haven't had one story about trying to get laid on the road. Because let's not be funny. Let's just parenthetically.
Right.
Every skinny, funny looking Jewish boy like me, that's why we went into comedy.
Okay.
Because, you know, if someone had told us that selling appliances would have been the way to meet girls, we would have said, show me the vacuums. So
okay.
The fact that we've not gone into any of this means basically you've no idea what the road experience. I'm not talking about what the road experience
I like to think
was.
This is very woke, this podcast.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, once they understand how pathetic
speaking as a married man
right.
who doesn't have to go on the road looking right. for anything.
Thank you.
Okay, so Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
the Comedy Works, run by Steve Young,
okay.
who is a comedian. And actually, recently, Rick Overton and Paul Venza made this point to me, which I never thought. I'm on stage doing this bit about Just Say No to Drugs, which
right.
was Nancy Reagan's thing. Just
Absolutely.
So I had this bit where I'd say, don't tell children to just say no because they're just going to generally, you know, I think one of the punchlines was a car pulls up to a kid and he's just supposed to say no.
Right.
You know, and I said, that's not going to teach your kids not to do drugs. That's going to teach a kid to be really rude to people who ask for directions.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm doing this bit, and then there's a woman in the audience who's blotto, but she hasn't been heard from yet.
Right.
And at that point, she makes a point that I'm supporting drug use among the youth. And then she wouldn't shut up for... So I did great.
Right.
Back
absolutely,
and forth.
Sure.
Great. She was just one of these people who just everything she said teed up a joke. So I'm doing great. But she's inconsolable. Or she's inconsolable, I guess is the word. But
okay.
Inconsolable and unquietable.
Okay.
Meanwhile, and hopefully Mike or one of you can ask, there was an umpire, baseball umpire. I think his last name was Page. Very large black man.
Yes.
And he lived in Philadelphia, and he was a fixture downtown.
Greg Page,
going to comedy clubs. So if we could shoot the movie, the comedy works, you're up high, and you look down into the audience, so everybody sees a sea of heads.
Sure.
So this woman and I go on and on and on, and then finally they just give up, and security comes, and they start leading her out. And Greg Page stands up. It's like, you know, it's a white audience. And then this one large black man rising out of the sea of white people. And he does the classic baseball, you're out of here. And I've never heard such a laugh.
Pandemonium.
Applause, pandemonium. He waves like he just hit a home run instead of being the ref. And then the coda to this about the Provenza and Overton were pointing out to me, I think that was maybe 20 minutes into, and I'm contracted to do 15 minutes,
right.
50 minutes
right,
on
sure.
the headline. So I keep going because I'm supposed to do 50 minutes.
Right.
And it's just, after that, it's just,
oh sure,
there's no way to come back from that. It's the biggest laugh ever. So I get off stage and I'm like, well, I did my 15 minutes. And Steve Young says to me, why didn't you get off after 20 minutes? I was like, you run the club. I can't do that. And he said, they would have taken you off on their shoulders if you had just gotten off stage. But what's interesting about it was, just the other day, this story came up, not the other day, but recently, and Provenza and Overton said, that's because he was a comic.
If
you'd have been a club owner, you would have gotten in trouble. But he was a comic, so he understood.
Right.
Just leave on the big laugh.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, if he was a club owner, you'd been like, good, you did your time.
Yeah.
Yep. You're out of here. Yeah. And so am I, folks. Good night.
Oh, that's great. And so am I.
Absolutely.
That would have been great.
And then your merch flies off the table. Speaking of out of here, I want to thank you guys for coming on and doing this today. I know it's been a long day at the Valeriano Podcast Studios. I appreciate it.
Well,
I've hung out in worse places.
All right, Mike.
I'm pressed to remember when. No, it was great. I had a good
thanks,
time.
Man.
Thanks
a lot
for
fun.
Having me again.
And absolutely. Well, I'm glad you guys could do it. And
happy to do this. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Oh, good. And I look forward to seeing you. I'll be seeing you guys more with the other project.
And
I'm
can
sure.
I just end? Great to be with Mike Ivey. He and I, 40 years.
That's amazing. I love it. Those are the best. These are the best episodes when you have friends who've been together for a long time. And like, I'll call some comics and have them come on. And I'm like, who do you want to do this with? And I'm like, whoever.
Yeah.
40 years and I still talk to him.
Hasn't been the same since he got out of rehab.
Unfortunately, he still talks to me. Well, folks, that's it.
All right, anything we can look forward to you guys coming up? Anything like that?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. Well, just because I like directing people to my workshops and stuff. So it's just Jonathan at allaboutthefunny.com. Jonathan at allaboutthefunny.com.
Teaching and writing and...
The shows where the workshops are and all that. And actually, though, right now, the website is under an overhaul. So they literally will go there and see like a landing page.
Okay.
But then they can always send me an email with their question.
All right, great.
And a few months from now, we'll be back up and running.
Okay, awesome. Excellent. Thanks, Jonathan Solomon, for doing this. Mike Ivey?
Yep. I'm auditioning at Casting Studios all over Hollywood and... anywhere else they ask me to come in.
All right.
And trying to get a podcast started.
Okay.
And which is challenging to say the least. But we're having fun and I'm still waking up funny every day. So.
Oh, there you go. Perfect.
And hopefully if my agent's in New York for the ghostwriting, that's not going to work. Somehow we need to put this out that they're making a mistake. They don't hire me later this afternoon. But I don't think...
They're not going to hear it.
That's going to work.
They're not going to hear it till next week.
Yeah.
Do it like the country music thing.
Right.
Lie your way in.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening, as always. Check out the Small Pods episodes going up this week with Bob Golub and Mike Rowe and all those guys and a few other people. This next episode will be from Seattle, where I'll be. You can check out all my dates. I'm on the road super heavy over the next 2 months. So check it out. If I'm coming to your town, stop by and say hi. Check out these guys. all their work. They're very funny. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Murray.
You want to know about life on the road? It's
booze, tacos, angry dwarfs, strippers waving guns,
and
fees, fights, candle flights, running with the runs,
and
blacklists, bounce checks, great, a bachelorette. Trunks in the front, making out through your set.
And
middle acts doing blow, more missing merch.
And
drive the rental car past another mega church.
And
juice, keys, vagina, fists, your cell phone is gone. One big Law and Order marathon.